October is Domestic Violence Awareness Month. If you haven't already, please watch and share Misty's domestic violence video, Escape. The link is on our Facebook page. Thanks in advance for doing your part to support this worthwhile cause.
What the heck is all... Ow! What are these pipes doing?
Yeah, you gotta be careful. They're pretty hot, Dad.
This is a whole vat of... What is that, wax?
Yeah. You know how Mom is making soap? I started making wax candles.
Okay.
Yeah.
The part fills with dread. What?
Oh, you don't have anything to worry about. You're the primary breadwinner around here. I gotta protect you, not Duncan.
Yeah, that's true. So you're making candles. That doesn't sound bad. Where are the candles?
Oh, they're right around back here. Here, come take a look. I'm very pleased.
They're huge. Wait a minute. They look like people.
Yeah, I just saw House of Wax, and it gave me a great idea.
Oh,
I call this
God one
Putterson.
That's Mr. Putterson from next door. Dipton, he's got a wick sticking out of his forehead.
Yeah.
Is that Super Rica?
Yeah.
Oh, my God.
Don't get him out of there. It'll ruin the art. I have a show next Friday.
Oh, my God. Is that Miss DeMore? Did you dip her in wax?
Yeah. I figured it wasn't any different than the way the rest of her body parts were.
Yeah, we can leave her. Okay. Hi, this is Paul Dini.
This is Misty Lee, and we have guests today,
yes.
And I'm so excited about them.
Now that we've chipped the rest of our cast out of wax and sent them on home. Rashi is getting more homicidal by the podcast.
More homicidal, as if he didn't start out that way. He tried to kill Super Rica the day we found him in the taco box.
Of course he did.
Yeah, so I don't know. I mean, how can you become more homicidal? Like, you are or you aren't, right?
Yeah.
So we have guests, and they're
guests.
Not dying, and they're not in wax. We have Max Maven. Actually, let me introduce Trish first.
We need to
get Max some fanfare. We finally have the elusive Trish Alasky, who's mentioned in every podcast,
That's
but
right.
never on.
She's never been on before?
Nope, no, never.
This
is her first time. She's nervous.
She actually exists.
I got the hard T when she found out. She's like, I am not going to be on the podcast.
I'm not nervous.
I said, yes, you are. Because... She was so nervous. Yeah, she's going to tell you she's not nervous. She was nervous. And then we have, do you have a drum roll, Ezra? Can you play a drum roll? Yes, he's nodding. Blah, 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 blah. Max Maven! I'm so excited that he's
Fable
here.
And legendary.
Yeah, of course. And here.
I can't possibly live up to this.
We're done.
You already have. We're just so damn excited that you're here. You don't even have to say anything. You just sit. Because we're just so damn thrilled. I talk about you on here all the time.
Now, could you talk about how the two of you met?
Where did we meet, Matt? I think we met several times.
Well, for people who don't know, Max Maven is one of the world's greatest magicians.
One of? He is the
and,
world's famous.
Yes.
Greatest.
Capital T.
Yeah.
Yes.
V with a capital T.
And the great,
author,
the foremost
performer.
Scholar of magic.
Absolutely. The man of letters. Actually, Max, are you the most prolific?
I don't know.
Because I would say you probably are.
I'm one of the most prolific.
Yeah.
Of who's still walking.
Yeah. Well, I mean, living or dead. I would prefer
I'm up
you.
There.
Oh yeah, I know you're up there.
it's a sad commentary on my social life.
No, it's not, because a lot of your social life has to do with this stuff. You're always meeting people and finding things out and researching and. You're a fancy man. He also has the unique distinction of having a very low Erdős number. Will you tell us?
I wouldn't say it's a unique distinction, but I'm in a rarefied group. I have a low Erdős number.
Will you tell them
what is an Erdős number?
I will tell you. Paul Erdős was a Hungarian mathematician, an extraordinary guy by all accounts, about whom there have been... two quite good biographies written, many articles, and a very nice documentary. And he was a very prolific and whacked out mathematician who was so central to many of the breakthrough ideas of 20th century mathematics that people actually assign Erdős numbers. So the idea being, because he was very prolific, if you wrote a paper with him, that would mean that you have an Erdős number of 1.
Okay.
Erdős himself had an Erdős number of 0.
Clearly.
And if you wrote a paper with someone who has an Erdős 1 number, that made you an Erdős 2, would give you an Erdős number of 2. I have an Erdős number of 3, which is pretty amazingly low for someone who's not a mathematician or an academic. And of course, as time goes on, the number of existing Erdős 3s becomes even smaller.
How did you get your 3?
I co-authored some work with Martin Gardner.
Okay.
Who was, Martin, among many other things, was the mathematical games columnist for Scientific American magazine over 25 years, during which time it was estimated that about 20% of the magazine's circulation was entirely due to his column, and that he was single-handedly responsible for introducing more people to mathematics than any other thing or person in modern history. And he died just a few years ago. I think he was 95.
Wow.
Speaking of prolific, a remarkably prolific writer about many things, not only about mathematics. And so I co-authored some papers with Martin. Now, Martin was included as a co-author of a mathematical paper. There are a pair of mathematicians, Ronald Graham and Fan Chang. I have met Ronald, I have not met Fan, but they are the sort of custodians of Erdős. When Erdős was alive, every time he published a paper, which he did far more than most mathematicians, he would send a copy to them. And so he was constantly in touch with them. And they became sort of the keepers of the flame, in a sense. And so on some paper that they wrote, they included Martin as an author because some ideas that he had analyzed somehow came into play in this paper. I don't know the full details. But that wound up giving Martin an Erdős number of 2,
mm-hmm.
since he published with Ron and Fan Chang, who have Erdős numbers of 1.
Yeah.
And I was once asked by a person who I won't mention so as not to embarrass him, but
I wish you would embarrass him.
He sent me an email, a fellow who some people listening to this might know him, but he sent me an email asking what my Bacon number was.
I was going to ask you
And I figured out my Bacon number is a 2, I think.
Okay.
But I wrote him back and I said, well, my Bacon number is a 2 or whatever I figured out it was, but my Erdős number is a 3. And this upset him very much. And he wrote me back and said, how could your Erdős number possibly be that mm-hmm. low? And I explained. And since he knew Ron Graham, he sent him an email saying that this can't count.
Of course it does.
Because he's talking about co-authoring a magic paper rather than
a
well, according to Ron Graham, it counted.
Good.
So
I agree
that's about
that it
as
should.
Close to getting Erdős to acknowledge that it's a legit number.
Erdős is much cooler than Bacon.
Well, harder to get low numbers.
Yeah, indeed. Everybody's 6 degrees away from Kevin.
When was Erdős active?
The latter half of the 20th century.
Oh, okay.
We said that, but you were busy.
Well, okay.
For those who are interested in Erdős,
how do you spell it?
It's spelled E-R-D-O-S, but there is an accent mark over the O that looks like two hash marks, two diagonal strokes,
okay.
which clearly is a pronunciation guide for Hungarian. So it's pronounced Erdős, even
Fair
though it
enough.
Looks like Erdos.
I should put that O on the front of
the titles of the biographies. The names of the authors, unfortunately, I don't know off the top of my head, but one is called The Man Who Loved Only Numbers, mm-hmm. and the other is called My Brain is Open. Mm-hmm. And cool. they're both really mm-hmm. good. They're both written for non-mathematicians. They overlap, not surprisingly, in some of their contents, and yet they're different. They're different takes on this one amazing guy. And the documentary, which used to be not that easy to obtain, but now in the days of digital, I'm sure you could find it online quite quickly, is called N is a Number. Huh. And so armed with that and typing ability, you should be able to find these on the internet almost without any effort.
Cool. So, okay, so we have to talk about magic, obviously, because it's what you do and it's where kind of where you're friggin' biking. Where do you want to start? Because I have so many questions for you. I've had people write in with questions, and people are going to want to know how you got your start. For people who don't know Max Maven, I don't know how you could possibly not if you've been listening to this thing, because I talk about him all the time, but whatever.
Can I start with something?
Yeah, would you like to tell us how you
got into magic? I have a fun story. Today, Max doesn't know this, today I was driving on La Brea, and yeah. I saw Max Maven walking down the street.
Okay.
And I thought, okay, well, when he gets closer to me, I will honk at him, and I will wave at him, and we will smile, and then we'll move on with our day. And
what happened?
He was walking, and then there was a bus, and then Max Maven disappeared.
What?
I swear to
you. I know exactly what moment that had to have happened.
Can I tell you how magical it is that you're about to get an answer?
It was at the liquor store.
I had lunch at a little restaurant, and then there's a little alleyway right next to that liquor store, which cuts across in the direction of a supermarket.
Oh, see.
And the bus must have gone by just as I got down the alley.
Or but did I just he set him up so well bus. As a magician.
No.
You disappear, and then, okay.
It's possible. He turned into a bus to
everyday
elude
magic.
You.
He disappeared on me.
He did. He saw you and was like, oh, hell no. If I'm going to turn myself into a bus.
It was amazing. That's my story.
Master illusionist and mentalist.
Yes.
When did you make the distinction? What did you choose? Or did mentalism kind of choose you? Well, should we talk about how you got into magic first?
Well, I got into magic the same way as most troubled prepubescents.
Couldn't get a date?
Well,
at
the age
you.
Of 7 or 8, I wasn't really looking.
No.
No, but I got involved with magic initially because it had this great appeal that I think it has to most young boys in particular in this society, although it's the number of women involved in magic, as you well know, is growing, and
it is,
and the societal constructs that have made magic so male dominated are changing slowly but surely.
I think magic
at least on the surface, magic is very much a power profession.
Mm-hmm.
And in our society and most Western society, women are not invited into power professions.
Correct.
Which is why female politicians are a relatively recent phenomenon, and there are still not that many of them relative to the number of men. Medicine, let's remember, it was only a few years ago that the first woman film director in history not only won the Oscar, it was the first woman who was ever nominated for an Oscar, if I'm not mistaken. So these are all power professions, and women have, up until very recently, not been welcomed in, which is not to say there haven't been some who have managed to say, well, the hell with your opinion, I'm going to enter this profession. But
a side note,
yeah,
we just had three that became magician members of the castle just this last month.
Well, there's no question that the number of women in the field of performing magic has been growing.
Mm-hmm.
And it will continue to grow, both because some of the societal rigidities are becoming less rigid, but also because we're finally reaching a point where young women, girls who are starting to be interested in magic, have the opportunity to see adult women doing magic,
mm-hmm.
not simply assisting or getting sewn in half, but actually being the magician. And having role models of their own within magic makes it a much more open door. It sends a message saying this is something you could try.
Mm-hmm.
Women, I think, approach magic, and I'm making a very sweeping statement here, but I think they approach magic a bit differently than men do, and I'll say that's particularly true in the case of little boys and little girls. And I think women tend to tackle problems and social problems, interpersonal problems, differently than little boys do. With little boys, it's all about leverage, and it's all about gaining control through power.
Mm-hmm.
And so the attraction of magic to little boys, and this is pretty widespread, I won't say it's universal, but it's damn close, is magic becomes a very functional tool, a coping mechanism for dealing with power imbalance. So you have some little kid who is having a difficult time with the relationships around him, with his siblings, with his parents, with his teachers, with the other kids at school, and the kid discovers, if I can make the coin disappear and mom doesn't know where it goes, if the teacher can't replicate this feat, now I've got power, I have leverage, I have
control.
Authority that helps define
ability
and knowledge.
Yeah, mm-hmm, yeah. Mm-hmm. So I think that's what draws most little boys into magic. I think little girls tend to be drawn to it for slightly different reasons, but I don't claim to fully understand that. I barely understand the little boy aspect. But that's certainly what drew me to magic in the first place.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
It isn't why I do it now, mm-hmm. but that is the doorway through which I entered.
And you said you were seven or eight?
Yeah.
How? What was your first exposure to magic?
I must have seen it on television,
okay.
but the first time I got to peek under the canvas of the circus tent, I was taught a couple of very primitive card tricks by an older cousin, and shortly thereafter was taught a string trick by an uncle,
mm.
And now I owned three secrets.
Yeah.
Where did you grow up?
I grew up in the Boston area.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Brookline, right?
Initially,
mm-hmm.
I was born in upstate New York,
mm-hmm.
Ithaca.
What?
I just discovered
she's also from there?
No, yeah. I didn't know that.
Albany.
Well, I was my parents were at Cornell at the time. My father was doing grad work,
mm-hmm.
And I just a day or two ago happened to stumble upon the fact that there's some like city boosting website about Ithaca.
I know where Ithaca is.
I just saw a bumper sticker
that
about
lists,
Ithaca the other day.
You know, famous people who were connected to Ithaca.
Uh huh.
And I made the list.
Yes,
of course you did.
Which is odd because, of course, I left before I was 1 year old, so
they
I have
don't
no
care.
Memory of this.
I think it's on your Wikipedia or something because I didn't know the story.
So then my family moved to Princeton.
That's awesome.
Princeton is where I met Albert Einstein.
Well, excuse
what?
Us.
What? I met him the other day. I swear to God. Aaron and I were at the grocery store.
He was on a bus and then he was...
And the man looked just like him. And
did he have his tongue out and everything?
He didn't have his tongue out.
No, I'm just teasing. He used to do that for photographs.
Okay, all right.
But we need to know how Max met Albert Einstein.
Well, I was approximately 1 year old and I was...
Well, you were a baby.
And my father... was in we'd moved to Princeton because he was at the Institute for Applied Science.
What'd your dad do?
In physics.
Okay.
So he was there for a year.
Wow.
And the story goes that he had me on a lawn somewhere.
Wow.
Doing whatever 1 year olds attempt to do,
and
that Einstein slowly drove by in his wood paneled station wagon and slowed his car down and leaned out the window and said, "Hello, baby." So that was my conversation with him. I didn't apparently.
And that is now the name of this podcast. Actual,
Hello, baby.
Hello, baby. It's Max Maven.
Asked by a genius.
So conversations with Einstein.
So having met Einstein, there was no point in staying further. So that's when we moved to Brooklyn, when I was about 2.5.
Okay.
And I had similar encounters with Don Ameche, of all people. He lived in I was born in New York, and he used to meet my mom in the lobby, and they would push me around Central Park. It would have been nice if
which
I had a carriage.
Which means that your mom ran around during the day with Don Ameche while your dad was at work.
I've long felt an affinity with Don Ameche based on one peculiar anecdote, which is when I was in my early 20s, just out of college, I went to a performance of a rock band that a friend of mine was in. Mm-hmm. And so this performance was being attended by high school kids.
Right.
So, kids a few years younger than I, but who seemed very young and desirable, I suppose. And this one young lady came up to me and said, "Oh, you look like someone." And I thought, okay, she's going to say some, you know, very trendy rock star of the moment. You know, she's going to say, "I look like Clapton," and I'm going to score. Uh-huh. And she thought for a moment and said, "Don Ameche."
So
I've always had a sort of disappointing connection with Don Ameche since then.
I'm sorry I brought it up.
It's a lot, Paul.
I didn't know.
You got the Christmas time is here from Trish. Whenever something happens like that, instead of giving you the womp womp, you did trumpet, she goes, da da da.
Hey, I would have rather have had, you know, Brando or somebody, you know, more of the moment than, you know, push me around the park. But
So I think it's super interesting that you had a magical family even before you were interested. Even though that wasn't what they did for a living, these people knew enough. Someone knew, you said, a rope trick or a string trick?
A cousin and an uncle. But yeah, but they were cool. Neither. But I think if you were to ask around, an awful lot of people have dabbled, at least minimally, in magic at some point when they were kids. And may remember enough. Neither this uncle nor this cousin ever pursued magic, and I don't think either of them knew anything beyond the simple tricks they shared with me. But I think if you were to look around, you'd find that a lot of people you know probably know.
Well, lots of grandpas pull quarters out of beers, but still.
Exactly.
Now, do you remember what the tricks actually were? Like, could you give the titles of them for magicians and could they look them up?
Well, these kids today won't know, one of the card tricks is customarily referred to as the Four Robbers.
Okay.
Which is a story trick with cards. It's a pretty good trick, actually. And then the other was a very primitive version of what is properly known as the Gergonne pile problem, which to most magicians that would not ring a bell. But
I don't
even
know what that is. No.
If I say the 27 card trick or the 21 card trick, that will ring a bell to most magicians, except this was as primitive as you can get. It was 9 cards.
Yeah.
But nevertheless, it was pretty good for a 7-year-old. I mean,
it
was right at my level.
And then, do you remember what the string trick was?
It was a cut and restored string. I mean, it was, you know, the kind of thing you see magicians do with rope, except that
it was a string.
It was a piece of string.
Okay.
Can I ask a question?
But it was enough, and that's really cool.
That's amazing.
It took hold.
The effect that they had on you.
Can I ask a question? Just for my own satisfaction here. About magic and math, because that's very interesting to me. Would you say the same part of the brain that controls the person's ability to do math also is what they rely on for magic and maybe music?
That's a really interesting question, and I don't know if I can answer it. There's no question that math is very much a part of music. We know
yes.
that.
Uh-huh.
And yet there are certainly great musicians who don't think in mathematical terms at all.
Right.
And who don't approach their music in mathematical terms.
Mm-hmm.
So I would say similarly, there are ways in which you can analyze theatrical magic in mathematical
Because what I've seen
ways, but I don't think that's how most magicians approach it.
Oh, okay. Because I've seen numerical magic, you know, where somebody has pointed out a common thread and a number.
Max has created a lot of that.
Yeah, it's beyond me. I can understand. I'm wrapped up in the theatricality of it. I can follow it to a point, and certainly to the resolution and to the payoff. How one goes about constructing something like that, I don't have any idea, because my brain doesn't process math very well, for whatever reason.
Max, you've created a number of those things. Where do you start?
Oh.
Do you have an ultimate goal in mind, and then you work backwards to get there? Do you...
It's never the same. It's okay. Never the same twice. I mean, every time I've created a magic trick, it seems like I'm entering from a different direction. If there was a formula to it, then I would be using that, I suppose, but I don't think there is. So sometimes the routing will be that I know what effect I wish to produce, and I have no idea how I'm going to do it, mm-hmm. and so I'll start trying to find ways to achieve that. But on the other hand, sometimes I'll become aware of a technical element, you know, a secret move or a secret gimmick or a secret principle or something, and say, mm-hmm. okay, well, how can I play with this? Mm-hmm. And it begins to develop into something.
Okay.
Sometimes someone else comes up with a piece of magic, which they then publish, let's say, and I'll see it and say, oh, there's a different way to, I can rethink this. I like this, but I can personalize it by adjusting the presentation this way, or by adjusting the method that way. It's never in the same pattern for me. It's never, and the process sometimes takes place almost instantaneously, and other times it can kind of drag on over a period of years.
Mm-hmm.
For me, it's very inconsistent. It's also inconsistent as to whether the results are any good, but sometimes they are.
See, I can equate a lot of that to writing, except from a different point of view. But some of the same things apply. Some of them don't.
Mm-hmm.
That's kind of why I ask, because it's like the construction of magic, and especially that that revolves around numbers, is such a mystery to me. But it was fascinating hearing how you go about creating that, and how those come to you. When I write a story, things come to me in a similar way.
Well, the performance, I think, in a very real sense, performance magic is a form of storytelling.
Mm-hmm.
And therefore, although I have never sat down to write a cartoon script or the kinds mm-hmm. of writing that you do,
mm-hmm.
I think there's very much a mm-hmm. kind of parallel between that and mm-hmm. what I do in trying to create a performance piece.
Now, talking about performance, you started off performing in, were you doing stand-up, or were you doing...
No,
or
music.
Oh, okay. No,
before that, I mean, my first performing was doing children's birthday parties.
Yeah!
Oh my gosh!
That makes me so happy!
We've all been there.
Wow. What did you do in your shows?
Pretty typical stuff. When I was about, I think around 12 is when I
balloon
I
started
uh-huh. doing them. Not only did I do some balloon animals,
yes.
I actually, at the time when I was around 13 or so, I invented the balloon animals that we're used to today are usually made with one balloon, one long skinny balloon that is called a 260 is the technical mm-hmm. name for that style of balloon. To show you how old I am, that was actually a new idea in the 1960s. Before that, they used to make balloon animals out of airship balloons, which are bigger. And so you would make balloon animals out of like six or eight of these airship balloons. Were they
like in the shape of a dirigible?
A little longer, but they weren't as bendy, twisty as the long.
That sounds like it's going to be really hard.
It was a different ballgame
and a little sad.
So when I was doing these children's birthday parties, I discovered balloon animals and said, this is great because you can get like 5-6 minutes out of a few cents worth of balloons. That's not bad.
Yeah, or like me, just teaching flying mice, and everybody
but the problem, gets to fly but the problem with balloon animals, I discovered, is that unless you're really good, I mean, I've seen some pretty extraordinary balloon animals,
mm-hmm. dresses,
but that wasn't me. So if you're a normal person opting
Twister.
On that, you know, you make a dog, you give that away, then you make a swan, mm-hmm. okay, give that away. Then you make another dog, but you give it a really long neck and you call it a giraffe.
Mm-hmm.
You give that away. And then you make another swan, but you use a yellow balloon and you pass it off as a duck. And then you're kind of done.
Oh.
That's kind of the repertoire of...
Well, you can also do a swan in green and call it a coiled cobra if you want to be a stinker.
I wasn't as clever as that.
Oh, I see.
But I figured that was pretty much my repertoire.
Okay.
And so in order to try
should
and stretch
I go out
that
and get
repertoire...
The pump and make him make us a swan right now?
Yeah, he did not work with the same material.
So, this is audio. I'll just make the noises.
Squeaky noises.
I'll support
wow,
you.
It's a whole herd of elephants.
Yeah. Exactly.
He's doing it
so
now.
I invented a trick.
What did you invent?
When I was like 13.
I'm not 14, when you said that, I was thinking to myself,
I invented
of
a trick
did.
Using a 260 balloon as a way of sort of stretching the balloon sequence
excuse
in my kids'
pun.
Show act. And that trick is being done today by
what is it?
Kid show performers.
I love this story.
Dennis Farrell and Suzanne Herring.
I don't know if either of the two people you just mentioned, I know both those people, but I don't know that either of them does it. But I do know some people who do it. There's a guy named Dick Osland who is up in years now, but who is very possibly the best kid show magician alive. He's in the Midwest, and he used to do 500 school shows a year.
Wow, my gosh.
And that meant working for, in some cases, hundreds of kids.
Yeah.
And dealing with, K through six, mm-hmm. which is to say mm-hmm. kindergarten all the way through sixth grade,
absolutely.
Which is an impossible audience, because mm-hmm. if you do something and the kindergartners like it, then the third graders don't want to like it.
Yep.
And if the third graders... don't like it, then the sixth graders either decide to like it to spite them or to dislike it more to be hipper. So, I mean, it's an impossible audience. Mm-hmm. And Dick was able to corral these huge throngs of kids by very clever and engaging means. And he used this trick. So
what is it?
So there you are. The effect basically is you show a 260 balloon uninflated,
yeah.
and you blow into it, and a bubble, you know, it starts to inflate, but instead of inflating at one end or the other as they normally do, it starts inflating in the center. So you blow, and a bubble appears in the center of the balloon, about the size of an egg.
Okay.
And then you pluck it off of the center of the balloon.
Oh,
okay.
I have seen
you
that.
Have been creating, inventing magic tricks since you were 13 years old?
Yeah, around that.
Wow. Uh-huh. Yeah. He used to take his allowance. And why don't you tell them what you used to do with your allowance when you were a little boy?
Oh, dear.
Hide it in his ear. Huh? Hide it in his ear.
Yeah. No, he's better than that. I'm going to go get a balloon animal. You're going to make one.
I have a question. How are we still talking?
Yeah, oh, you're waiting. Still talking. I'm going to do it back.
When did you become Max Maven, as we know Max Maven today?
A gradual process. I don't think, when does the tadpole become a frog? I don't know that there's
But the look and all that
day.
Had to be...
At one point he looks back and says, hey, that's new.
Because you have the most unique, but how do you say it, I guess? Most no, it's unique but real. Look out of any magician I think that there is.
I think I've just been complimented, but
yes,
I'm not
sure.
Yes,
you have. I'm not
yes,
saying it properly.
That
anyway, that developed in the early to mid-70s.
Okay. Just a side question. I dig it.
So what do you do with your change?
Oh, well what Mr. is referring to is in the 1960s when I was in my early teens, by which time my family was living in Newton, which is a suburb of Boston, mm-hmm. and there was a magic shop in downtown Boston called Holden's that had been there since the 30s, I think, or 40s. Oh, yeah. And I used to go in pretty much every Saturday. I would take the, there was a train that merged into the subway of downtown Boston. And I would go in and hang out at the shop all day and see what was new and soak in everything I possibly could.
I was Needham's, took the same train in, went to Jack's Jokes.
I went there as well, but, yes. But Holden's yep. didn't have the dog poo, so.
No,
there were three joke shops in downtown Boston. They all had the name Jack in their name.
One was Jack's, one was the most bizarre masks.
One was Jack's, one was Little Jack Corners, and one was Jack and Jill's. I never did find out which one came first.
I think I went to Jack Horner's because I think they had weird costumes and monster masks in the window. I remember like it had an old-fashioned Boston, you know, front window, and they had like these leering clown and animal heads in the window.
I think that could have been any of them, actually.
Yeah.
So, but I would go to Holden's, and in those days, the round trip on the train was 35 cents.
Yeah.
It was 25 cents to get downtown and a dime to get back. Jesus, I'm old. Wow. So
no, you're not.
So I would go and hang out, and this was back at a time in the mid-60s when you could pick up a decent magic trick for a dollar or less, depending on what it was you were buying, but you could get something decent for that. But there were plenty of Saturdays when I didn't have a dollar to splurge. I managed to wrangle my 35 cents for transportation, and I might have almost nothing beyond that to spend. I don't want to make it sound like I was living in poverty. It was just my...
Well, you were a kid.
My middle class parents had said to me, it's your hobby, you pay for it.
Absolutely,
so,
and that's reasonable.
But what was great was that at Holden's there was a cardboard box of magazines, magic magazines, which were 10 cents a piece, except for Abra's, which were 5 cents. Abra was a weekly publication from England that was small relative to Magic magazine size. It was digest size and somewhat thin because it came out every week, and so it was only 5 cents. So I quickly figured out that even when my funds were low, I could always come away with a couple of magazines. And that I could learn more from the pages of magazines and books than splurging on props. And so I think that's what you were referring
exactly
to about
what
my money.
That's exactly what I was asking about, yes.
So that kind of started me in a good path as far as approaching magic with an interface with its literature. And, it also gave me a very oddly well-informed knowledge base about the social world of magic in England in the 1950s.
But it also, as a result of your immersion in those publications, you made a friend at a convention once with, I believe it was it Jay Marshall? Isn't that how you met him?
Oh, wow. You listen to these stories.
Max Maven.
Jay Marshall was...
I'm Max Maven, big fan, obviously. Huge fan.
Jay Marshall was one of the most extraordinary people ever. He was a magician, but also just an encyclopedia of show business history.
And used to work with his son,
spectacular performer in his own right.
Yeah.
What did you say?
Mentioned Sandy. Isn't Sandy related to him?
Sandy is Jay's son, and Sandy produced my theater show off Broadway.
Yes, excuse us. We have an off Broadway performer in our living room.
Just
last year.
Mm-hmm.
Last year.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
I love Sandy.
A year and a half ago.
He's very sweet.
Yeah. So Jay, I met Jay in 1965, at which time I would have been 14. So. Mm-hmm. He wouldn't have remembered meeting me, but I mean, I ran into him at various conventions and things, and over the years, I started to make a name for myself as a clever young guy, and so when I was in my my early 20s and started to become known as a somewhat clever lad or something.
Were you known as a performer, as a writer, a creator, or
a bit of all.
Mm-hmm.
And so Jay knew who I, by then, now Jay did know who I was, and we had a friendly relationship. But there was a moment that really kind of suddenly blossomed as far as our friendship, and it's, I believe this is what you're
talking about. It's exactly what I'm talking about, but they don't know.
I was at a magician's convention in Philadelphia in 1976. You remember Legionnaire's disease?
Oh,
yes,
yeah.
Yes, I do.
This convention took place at the same hotel 1 week before.
Oh, God.
Oh, Lordy.
Do you know what Legionnaire's disease? It came through the vents in this hotel, and a bunch of people got really, really sick.
There was
sick.
An American Legion convention at a hotel in Philadelphia, and a slew of people got sick, and a few of them died. And for a while, nobody knew what the disease was or how it had spread. Mm-hmm. They just knew it was all the people who'd been at this convention at this hotel. And Jay Marshall actually got a phone call from the FBI when they were in the week or so following. No, but they said, we understand that you had a magic stand, a dealer's stand, at a magician's convention at this hotel a week before the American Legion convention. And were you selling like weird chemical things or... They were trying to find if these magicians and their weird props had actually caused Legionnaire's disease.
I love that people think we are the devil because we are.
Anyway, so at that convention, there was a gathering in someone's hotel room. And so there were a bunch of people sitting around talking, exchanging stories and tricks and whatever. And I was sitting on the floor with some other young magician. I guess we were probably trading card tricks or something. And Jay was sitting on a chair halfway across the room. And he kind of idly did a hand gesture. You know how you'll sometimes sing a snippet of a song or quote the punchline of a joke for no particular reason?
Yes.
It's not even necessarily relevant to the moment. It just sort of comes to mind and flows through you. Mm-hmm. Well, Jay... Here, I'll tantalize the listeners by doing it for you here in the room. He did this.
Okay.
All right. He did an action with two hands, a kind of
magical,
elegant moment of two hands. And he didn't do it to me or for me. He just sort of did it to the ether, but I happened to be looking up and I saw him do that. And I said, Roy Benson, cover of the New Phoenix, 1951 or so?
Wow.
And his eyebrows went up.
I should say.
Because, first of all, he knew that in 1951 I was in diapers.
Yeah.
He knew that this referenced, therefore, stuff that was published long before I was alive and that, or functional, I should say. And that most people of my then age, I was at that point in my mid-20s, would not have ever read, let alone... retained, and also that it was in a field other than mine, because it was a gesture connected to a manipulative flourish with playing cards, and I don't do that type of work. So what this told him in a very instant way was that I read and cared about things beyond the kind of superficial level that most of the people my age perhaps were. And we were suddenly good friends. I mean, that really was the start of we were good friends for the next 30 years. Mm-hmm. And I think our friendship was based on a lot of things, but I think that was really a defining moment that he kind of suddenly realized that I had a bit more on the ball than maybe he'd realized.
You knew your stuff.
Mm-hmm. I knew some stuff.
It's to a surprisingly high degree. So after that, you were talking about how you started performing. You started in children's parties.
Yeah.
That's a pretty far cry from the Max Maven we now know. You know, I mean, like, I would say Princess Magic is maybe a little closer to the Max Maven we know, only because she's, you know, like, not a kid's party. But to go from kids' parties and in earnest at 12, and do you remember what was on the roster then? Like, were you doing
I was doing pretty classic stand-up magic. Billiard balls, mm-hmm. the egg bag, mm-hmm. Some rope routines. I mean, these are you know, the 20th century silks. Anybody listening who has any
all the stuff in Princess Magic's box
basic
right now.
Magic background, rabbits. But that's all solid material. It's Absolutely. Not. I mean, it can certainly be mangled, but it's stuff that, if done reasonably, with reasonable competence, it's actually pretty good magic. So, mm-hmm.
So at what point did the transition begin from? Well, balloon animal artist.
I certainly knew that performing for kids' birthday parties was not my goal.
Yeah, well, okay.
But it was an outlet. It was a chance to do magic and actually get paid a pittance for it. I was reading voraciously and took up a great interest in card magic. And then somewhere in my mid to late teens, began to discover mentalism. Mm-hmm. But I had, in a rare moment of clarity, I realized that I was too young to perform mentalism.
What do you mean?
Why? Well, because I don't feel, there are certainly exceptions to every rule of this sort, but as a general rule, I don't think mentalism can be properly performed by an adolescent.
Do you think it's because they lack pathos? Do you think it's because
because they lack authority.
Fair enough.
They won't be taken seriously.
And mentalism, generally speaking, requires a certain type of authority. And I just knew. I kind of twigged to that. And so, although I would say that sometime in my high school years is when I started studying mentalism in earnest, I wasn't really performing it.
Okay.
I was mostly, as I had essentially veered away from little kids' birthday parties, I would mostly do card tricks and some other close-up magic as well, but mostly card tricks. And began inventing card magic in earnest as well around this time. And studying mentalism, but not doing it. And it was really not until I was out of college that I transitioned over a period of a couple of years into doing stand-up mentalism.
Interesting. Do you remember, I have a bunch of questions about that. Do you remember when your first actual mentalism gig was and where it was?
Well, I can't really give you a good answer for that because it didn't happen on one occasion. It was a transition over a period of a couple of years. I was working in the Boston area and found, I got sidetracked. This is going to edit down into something actually interesting, isn't it?
It's extremely interesting.
I got sidetracked.
Right? It's fascinating.
I was out of college. I wanted to find work, and there was no work. There were no nightclubs.
What was your degree in?
American civilization with a minor in primary education.
Primary education.
Interesting.
You and the babies.
So. So I was trying to find work, and which wasn't really available. The nightclub industry had, at that point, we're talking now the mid-70s.
To find work, you mean work as a magician, not according to your degree, because you knew that you were going to be a magician no matter what. So did you just kind of finish school because that was a thing to do, because that was what your parents expected of you? Like, why would you pursue your degree?
I went to college in part because it was expected, in part because it got me a draft deferment,
which was during the
Vietnam War. In part because it just sort of, I'm not sure other options were, I mean, it was just presumed that I would. I came from an academic family. Mm-hmm. But I didn't go to college to learn how to do something for a career.
Okay.
I didn't know for sure what I was going to do as a career, but I knew it probably wasn't going to be something that I prepared for with an undergraduate degree.
Okay.
And so after college, I was making money, not very much of it, but from bits and pieces of this and that. I was doing occasional magic gigs, but there weren't a lot to be had. Some music gigs as well. playing lounge piano and stuff.
I didn't know you played piano.
I used to.
So not only did you play piano, but you also used to perform. Can we say this, like on the podcast, what you used to do with the band, with the James Brown? You were the front man.
I used to front soul bands.
He used to front soul bands, not just any soul band.
Well, it was James Brown style. So
So he did the dance,
singing
and everything.
And screaming and dancing and doing knee drops and things.
Whoa.
That I would not be able to do today.
Bet you could.
I bet he could too.
So
I'm not going to make you,
while
but
making
I bet
a balloon
you could.
Animal.
So
I just want to put that out there, that not only how diverse you are as a performer, because so many people know you as who you are today and who you have been for so long because you have honed and refined. I guess I don't mean to be callous and use the word brand, but that's exactly what it is. Like, that's the modern vernacular for what this is. You've got this character, this individual, which is a, knowing you personally is a heightened version of who you are and what you love anyways. You know, I would think, I don't know how much of it has been appropriated or you've grown
fair,
into over the years, but you like the creepy shit anyways. And you know, you're just really good at, right. So, and you feel a kindred connection to that stuff, but not only are you able to own that, you started creating magic at the age of 13. You were able to do children's parties well enough and entertain the kids enough to make a living doing that. And
let's not exaggerate. I wasn't making a living.
You were a 40-year-old.
12 or 13 years old. I was doing birthday parties, but I was living at my parents'. I was 12 or 13 years old. That's hardly making a living.
Please let us believe that you're making a living.
Yes, I was out there making a living doing children's birthday parties.
In New York. He was driving himself.
Yeah, the Back Bay apartment. And
He was given his independence from his parents because he just couldn't with them anymore. I'm not done. Because you friggin' fronted a James Brown band and did the knee drops and the dancing.
But it sounds like you at some point needed to make a decision on what route to take.
Yeah, and I did. I realized I had to make a choice between the two.
It sounds like you would have been successful either way.
He's successful no matter what he does.
No, that's certainly not true. But
what are you bad at?
But
what? Give me one thing
you don't have
at.
Enough time on this podcast.
One thing.
Find out what that one thing is next week on Radio Rashi with Max Maven. This has been another episode of Radio Rashi. If you've enjoyed this episode, let everyone know by leaving a review in the iTunes store. It's a great way to help others find us. You can also leave comments on RadioRashi.com, Facebook.com/RadioRashi, or follow us on Twitter at Radio Rashi or at Paul_Dini to leave us questions. Thanks for listening, and tell your friends.